Welcome to your commercial-free, uninterrupted investment show, sponsored by the SEC-registered investment firm, Wilsey Asset Management, a fiduciary firm owned and operated by President Brent Wilsey, who has been putting clients' investment needs first for over 40 years. The Smart Investing Show has been giving unbiased financial information for over 27 years on local radio stations right here in San Diego, providing you with fundamental analysis on stocks and investments you want to know about. Now, here are your hosts, Brent and Chase Wilsey.
Well, hello and welcome to the Smart Investing Show. I'm Brent Wilsey, president of Wilsey Asset Management. Great to have you here with us today. We got a lot of things to talk about, and oh boy, yesterday was the jobs report for March. We'll talk about that. Also, the JOLTS, which talks about, that comes out prior to the job market. We'll tie those two together for you, explain what that is. Also, too, office rents. We're going to discuss what the what's going on with the office rents. They up, down, where are they going? And then also, too, gas, hybrid, electric vehicles. What is going on in the vehicle market? We'll discuss that. And with me is Chase Wilsey. Chase, we're talking about what companies today?
Yeah, we got some good ones today. Excited to take a look here. We ran out of time last week, so we're going to look at Visa a little bit closer. Also going to look at one of our favorite companies for people that have followed us for a long time. I'm talking about Tesla, and I'm being facetious here. Many people know we have not been big Tesla bulls for many, many years. We'll look at what's going on now with the stock down to start the year. Maybe there's some value there, maybe not. Another thing too, Disney, they had that proxy battle. Let's look at the numbers there. And last thing, if we have a little bit of time, maybe we'll make things a little spicy. I'm talking about McCormick here. We're going to look at the spice maker, again, McCormick. So got some good stocks here, good companies, good show here in store for our listeners.
All right. Well, let's get right to it. Let's talk about the jobs report, because a lot of stuff weighs on that jobs report as far as what the Fed's going to do, what the economy is doing. And I must say, I was very surprised by the strength in the March jobs report. Non-farm payrolls increased 303,000 in the month, which easily topped the estimate of 200,000. And unlike prior reports, there wasn't a major change to the previous month, as February saw a negative revision of just 5,000. And January's revision brought the total up by 27,000. There were many positives report, considering the unemployment rate ticked lower to 3.8%. The labor force participation rate actually increased 0.2 percentage points to 62.7. And average hourly earnings, well, they increased 4.1%.
And that increase in average hourly earnings, that was lower than last month's reading of 4.3%. And I want to go back real quick to the revisions. It's funny because I think last month or the prior month, it was like, wow, the headline number was great, but they revised the previous month down by like 100,000 jobs. It was a huge revision, so it was nice to see a strong report and not much revisions there. But areas of strength in the economy included, no surprise, I'm going to say, as it's been a leader for many months, healthcare and social assistance, that grew by 81,300. Government was up 71,000. As you know, we're normally not big advocates for seeing that government growth in jobs, as it's not a pure indicator, essentially, of the private market actually creating those jobs. Leisure and hospitality was up 49,000. And construction was up 39,000 as well. According to the BLS, the leisure and hospitality sector is finally now back to its pre-pandemic level. And I feel like it's been something that we've looked at for a long time. And we're like, wow, this sector is finally back to pre-pandemic levels. Leisure and hospitality was the final holdout in theory, and they have finally hit that level. If the economy and labor market do continue to remain resilient, I do worry you may not see those three interest rate cuts we have been expecting during the remainder of the year, though.
And what we actually have here, too, is that we've got a situation. Let's kind of break this down a little bit to where the government jobs, because you see that 71,000 government jobs. Oh, that's just the government hiring people, just trying to boost the number. And that's not really the case. We have to remember that the government does have a lot of infrastructure rebuild going on. That does fall under that. And then also, too, the leisure and hospitality. Glad to see that's still going strong. But a lot of these jobs, and again, we've talked about this before, I'm not against immigration. I'm for good immigration. But what's actually happening, a lot of these jobs are coming from immigration into the the hospitality and also the health area.
Yeah, and it's something that, you know, watching CNBC, Lael Brainard, who is, I forget her exact title, I think the treasurer.
Fed?
Yeah, she's like the chief economist, or I don't remember the exact, because Janet Yellen's Treasury Secretary, I forget her exact role, but she's one of the higher ups in the economic department for Biden. She was talking about the jobs report, and they had asked about immigration. Of course, she didn't want to give any kind of real numbers on immigration. But then David Kelly from JP Morgan was talking about how immigration has really kind of benefited the jobs market. And that's why we continue to really see such a strong job market, because there are so many people coming into the country that you keep creating more jobs because of a higher supply of workers, essentially. And, you know, he didn't have, I'd say, necessarily any exact facts on it, because I don't know if they're public facts on that immigration level to start the year. But he did bring up the point that if somebody comes in illegally, I guess after 6 months, they can kind of start working here. But then, you know, they might not have a court date for 5 years. So, I mean, right. They can be part of the workforce. And again, I'm not an attorney. I don't know the exact way immigration breaks down. This is just what I heard from him. But, I mean, it makes sense as to why that labor market has remained so strong.
And not getting into a political debate here, I mean, strictly looking at the economy, it is a positive for all these immigration people coming in and working these jobs, because that's keeping our economy growing. And I will point back to the 1900s. And if you do your history research, you will find out that when the United States was building railroads, I believe the number was as high as 5 million immigrants from China came in to help build those railroads. And that was a huge benefit, a huge boost for the economy. We have that same situation now. Now, I do wish that it was done legally and they were kind of vetted. But the thing is, this is a economic thing that is actually helping the economy grow, because those jobs are being filled. And then those people do spend money here. They go out to dinner. They do different things, keeping the economy going strong through these jobs.
Well, not only that, but it's also, I'm going to say, a positive to wage inflation. Wage inflation, people have worried about being too hot, pressuring overall inflation. You know, I'm going to say that a lot of the immigrants coming in, they generally take lower paying jobs. So that actually puts a positive spin on wage inflation, because you're not going to see wages grow as much in that subsector of the economy. So that's been positive for wage inflation as well.
Yeah. So let's move on and kind of tie that into the JOLTS report. And in the job opening and labor turnover survey, again, JOLTS, it showed that there were 8.8 million jobs opening in February, which pretty much matched expectations and last month's reading. The job market has continued to remain resilient, and I do believe it will need to enter a Goldilocks period.
Yeah, and the Goldilocks period, obviously, not too hot, not too cold. Too many job openings may deter the Fed from considering rate cuts, and obviously we do not want a weak labor market, as that would just be bad for the economy overall. And again, this ties back into the overall jobs situation, because if the jobs market remains hot, as I said, I do worry. I mean, we've talked a lot that we think we could have 3 rate cuts. I didn't see the labor market remaining this strong, to be honest with you. I mean, that could completely change the outlook for the Federal Reserve. I mean, if inflation still remains, I'm going to say, at 2.5%, not the Fed's target of 2%, jobs still are growing at 300,000, let's say, and the GDP is still growing over 2%. I think it's going to be hard to make the case to cut rates 3 times.
Yeah, and that's very important. You brought up the GDP, because the GDP, I think if it comes in at 2.5%, 3%, you got the great job market. There is maybe no reason to cut interest rates, because and it doesn't mean the stock market won't do well, because if the economy is that strong, businesses will be making more money, more profits. That's a positive. PE ratios will fall. So therefore, it will still be good. You'll have maybe that short-term concern like, oh my gosh, rates were not cut. But if the economy is strong, job market's strong, you know, let's hold off on cutting rates until something major happens where you need to really cut rates.
Yeah, I mean, I know you used to always kind of tell me it's like basically reloading your bullets, essentially. You know, you'd hate to kind of shoot off the bullets and then all of a sudden you actually come into a situation where you need to use those bullets and now you have a problem. It's like, hey, we can save the rate cuts for when the economy does actually look to be like it's slowing. And I think the big question is going to come down to, again, that GDP. Because if you have sub 2% GDP growth, I think, yeah, of course you can make the case to cut rates. And I've heard a lot of economists, what they're saying still too is, well, you can make the argument that it's a healthy cut in the rates. It's not they're stimulating rate cuts. It's just trying to go from a tightened economy or tightened, you know, interest rate environment to a more normalized environment. So, I mean, honestly, there's a lot of data coming out, and it's obviously all expectations at this point, but it's very dynamic, I would say.
Hey, we're going to talk about the stock market, but again, along with that, even our own investment portfolio, it's very hard. I mean, I would like to not have the rate cuts and have things fall so we can do some buying, because volatility means things go up and down. We will maybe go down because, oh, they're not going to cut rates. That's fine, because then, oh, July or so, you'll start getting the second quarter reports of how the companies did. If they come out with better sales, better earnings, oh, guess what? It's going to turn around and go back up. So maybe we don't want a rate cut in June.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's something that I guess there's so much data coming out that it's overwhelming. I mean, I don't envy the Fed. It's a very difficult job, obviously, to try and keep the economy growing. You know, they have kind of the dual mandate, essentially, of employment and inflation. And I mean, I think a lot of it's, as I mentioned, GDP. I think if inflation were to get close to that 2% target, I think then they can kind of fixate on the idea of rate cuts. I'm almost to the point of saying, well, maybe the labor market doesn't matter as much in terms of analyzing the rate cuts. Maybe it is going to come down more to the GDP and the inflation rate as to whether they cut rates as we exit the year.
Well, let's talk about the stock market, because it has gotten off to a strong start. And in the first quarter, the S&P 500 was up 10.2%, which marked the best first quarter performance since 2019. The Dow and NASDAQ also had good quarters, as they were respectively up 5.6% and 9.1% in Q1. In a recent study, it was pointed out that that of the 16 times the S&P 500 rose 8% or more in the first quarter from 1950 through 2023, only once, that was 1987, did the index lose ground the rest of the year.
Funny enough, too, in 1987, the market was actually up for the full year, even though it was a 34% drop.
And people don't know that.
Yeah. Also, too, we like to put out, in the remaining years, the index gained an average of 9.7% over the next three quarters. So just because you had a strong first quarter doesn't mean that, hey, you know, the rest of the year is going to be bad. I mean, there's still some hope that you could have some decent returns. In 10 of the 15 years, the first quarter's gains were higher than those seen over the remainder of the year, though. So while this is bullish for the remainder of the year, I do worry about the concentration of the market. With NVIDIA's strong start and large market cap, it did account for close to half of the entire gain for the index. So I do wonder, again, going back over those 16 times the index has notched that type of gain in the first quarter, has such a large concentration of that gain come from one company? The reason that's important is I don't believe this will be able to continue, but I'm optimistic that the rally could continue to broaden, which would be beneficial for other stocks. So if NVIDIA continues to maybe flatline, go down a little bit, the Magnificent Seven don't do as well, but you know, I'm going to pick on energy. I'd say pick on energy. I'm pointing out energy. Energy is such a small component of the S&P. If that continues to do well through the rest of the year, it's not going to lift the index like the technology stocks have lifted the index.
And Chase, for clarification, you said NVIDIA's strong start, that NVIDIA alone counted for half of the entire gain of the index in the S&P?
Correct.
Wow. I wonder what it did for the NASDAQ. Probably even more.
Probably even more, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I think it was last week we talked about CMGI, so be careful with these strong starts on companies where they're over-concentrated. And again, I mean, when you look at investing equities, you've got to look at what you're paying for something and what you're getting. You've got to understand what's going on, because if you don't, you're going to get burnt, and you're going to then start doing emotional things to where it's going to go down, which it is. It's going to go up and down, and you're going to sell because, oh, this is over, and you're going to miss things. That's why we invest in individual equities, so we understand those businesses and we don't panic, because when they go down, as we said, we love when they go down because we can step in and buy more.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something you can't time the stock market, but you can understand the values of your companies. And, you know, sometimes we'll sit on cash. Like I'll let people know right now we're sitting on a little bit more cash than we normally do. It's not because we're trying to time the stock market necessarily. It's just we're trying to find good values, and we're not going to jump into something until we understand it and until we find something that is at a good valuation.
Yeah. Well, let's move on and talk about office rents, because across the country, office rents are holding firm, and I'm sure that surprised a lot of people, and they are higher now than they were back in the fourth quarter of 2019. The average U.S. office rent has an asking price of $35.24 per square foot. This is an increase from $34.92 per square foot back in 2019.
Now, it's not a high increase, obviously. What is that, like 30 cents, 32 cents it looks like?
Yeah.
But the reason it's important is compare that to a lot of the negativity we've seen from the media as they've shown how terrible things are and office rents as a whole. Well, they look okay. And again, the media's like, oh my gosh, office is terrible. Nobody's going in. You would think that office rents would have fallen by 50%, but clearly not the case. I would recommend for investors, though, looking into the office real estate space to really do their due diligence to make sure they are not buying or investing in a declining property. I mean, you know, we've talked about this a lot on the show that we have investments in commercial properties, but, you know, I'm not going to buy a commercial property that's Class B, Class C, maybe in concerning areas of the country as well, like San Francisco. That's very high risk. I think that San Francisco rents, yeah, there could be a lot more consolidation there. It could be troubling, or that's where you could find the best values in theory. I know Warren Buffett's disciple, lieutenant, he's
protege,
talked about it.
Protege, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think they just talked. I think they actually did it.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, I believe they did it. And the difference is they're not saying, okay, we'll make money in 6 months. This is a great trade. They're saying, where will this be 5 to 10 years from now? And in the meantime, we'll collect rents. We'll redo this. I mean, that's how the wealthy make money, not by looking at a 3 month or 6 month trade, by getting something for value and saying, where will this be in the years to come? And that's a big thing people miss when it comes to investing.
Where I wanted to point out that Warren Buffett situation, though, and again, it's not Warren Buffett. I forget which one. I think it's Todd Wexler, Tom Combs. I think it was one of those
was
gentlemen.
It one of those? Oh, I thought it was somebody different.
I believe
okay.
It was.
Okay.
But it's somebody that came under the protege from Warren Buffett, essentially. Is I don't think the average person is knowledgeable enough to be buying real estate in San Francisco right now is my point.
Correct.
I think you'd be better off buying something again in the Sun Belt, areas of the country that are doing well, that have strong rents, because you can still find good values there. You may not get a 3x multiple essentially on your money. Like, if this works out for this gentleman in San Francisco, I mean, that could be a huge gain for him. But the average person doesn't understand it well enough, I think, to do it. I'd be very careful, I guess, is what I want to point out if you're looking at investing in the office space, because there's a lot of inherent risk at this point in time.
And I do want to point out, too, is that's why we like REITs, Real Estate Investment Trust. Now, you are not going to get the depreciation. Maybe you won't get some of the tax benefits. But you get professional management. You get diversification. Make sure you still got to do your homework. You can't say, okay, well, this REIT here has done pretty good. You've got to really understand what they're investing in, what the leverage is, what is the rents, what's their FFO, all these important things. It takes you a long time to understand that. But once you get it, you've got a professional manager that's managing that real estate for you. And generally, the yield on that you're getting on your money is, depending on the REIT, we'll call between 5 and 7%. I mean, REITs are a very good investment, but you have to know, just like an equity, you have to understand what you're getting and not just blind it because, oh, I get an 8% yield.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where people are going to make mistakes, and especially with the decline in real estate in the market to start the year or over the last couple of years even, I think people are going to get very short-sighted with it and sell at the wrong times, essentially. So, you know, you got to know what you're doing in the space, otherwise you're going to burn yourself.
Yes. So let's talk briefly here on gas, hybrid, and electric vehicles. The U.S. car buyer seems confused on whether to buy an electric vehicle or a gas-powered vehicle. So they have decided to cut down the middle and just go out and get a hybrid.
Yeah, actually, in the first 2 months of 2024, this caused sales of hybrid vehicles to increase 50% over last year. I mean, I'm just shocked by that. I mean, hybrids have been around for so long. I mean, the Prius, I remember when I was in high school, I had a couple friends that had Priuses.
Yeah.
And I mean, what, high school now was that? 2000, so yeah, was it like 15 years ago?
Yeah, it was quite a while ago. And I got to say, the new Prius, have you seen the new Prius?
No.
It looks a little bit sporty. It's kind of got like some lines to it. I don't think I'd buy one because I like a bigger vehicle, but it's just like, it looks kind of nice. And I remember they used to be like only 24 grand. I don't think they go for now. But the hybrid seems to be, and I would get a hybrid myself. I kind of like the hybrid. I don't like the EV. I like the gas, but a hybrid's kind of like, cut it in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, it's I remember I I didn't buy it. I leased a Ford Fusion. That was my first car after college.
A Ford Fusion? I thought it was a Hyundai.
No, it was a Ford Fusion. After college, it was a Ford Fusion.
Oh, after college. Okay, that's
and,
right.
And I remember I was looking at the hybrid versus not a hybrid, and I don't know why. I guess I didn't drive enough to get the hybrid.
Right.
Because they do come still at a premium to the, or at least at this time, they came at a premium to the ICE or the internal right. combustion engine.
And I don't know if the gas, I know on the Prius, it was like, I think you get like 50 miles a gallon. But I think on other hybrids, I even thought about buying an Escalade as a hybrid. But I don't think the gas mileage is that much better. I think it goes from, I don't know, like 14 to maybe 16 or 17. But people are buying them. I mean, they can't decide. So,
I know Ford, I think, this last week came out too and said they're kind of slowing down on EV plans and kind of, I'm going to say, doubling down essentially on hybrids because that's what the people are wanting.
Right. Now I will say, and are we talking about an oil company today? Maybe we will talk about an oil company.
I didn't tease with it because it's our fifth company.
Yeah,
I
may
don't
not
know if
get,
we'll get
to it.
So we'll maybe next week if we don't get to it today.
And let's just really, since we're on the hybrid EV side, I think that could change because we have seen oil. I think, didn't oil hit I think $90 a barrel today?
I think it did hit 90. And I don't know if that was WTI or Brent, right. But I
think
did remember
Brent
hearing
is usually
90.
Higher than WTI.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I know oil has come up because that will change things. All of a sudden, if you start seeing prices, the pump go up, ooh, well, maybe I need an EV because now it costs X dollars to fill my tank. So, and actually, we always do talk about, and it has changed now, the average age of the vehicle on the road in the U.S. is, what did I say, 12.6 years, was it?
12.6, 12.7,
yeah.
I believe, yeah.
Yeah, and
and we did talk about it today as well, not to get onto Apple's kind of concept, but, you know, I always tell people, oh, the average age of an iPhone now is so much older than it used to be. It's like, well, yeah, because the iPhone hasn't changed that much. And we kind of talked about the same situation with cars where, you know, maybe the average age of the car has crept up because, well, cars, frankly, haven't changed that much either compared to, I mean, you know, you go back to the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. I mean, I think that the change in cars over decades was much larger
yeah.
than they were compared to today.
Right, exactly. So, all right. Well, Harrison's on vacation this week, so he'll be back next week. But we now have time to talk about a couple more companies. We're going to start off with Visa because Visa's been in the news, well, quite a bit, along with the government. And I don't know if you brought the numbers, but how the federal government made them cut what they're charging the merchants, and it was not very much. I think it was like 0.07 to 0.09%. I don't think it barely is going to move the needle. Do you have that number or no?
I think it's in our newsletter from last week, but yeah, I know it was, I think it was 0.07 to 0.04, and then it's capped for 5 years, and you know they're like, oh, it's going to save $30 billion over 5 years, but you know, $6 billion a year essentially on the 20 plus trillion dollar economy is, you know, it sounds like a lot more than it is in my opinion.
And it's not going to really benefit the consumer or I think even the merchant. And by the way, you brought up the newsletter. I forgot to tell people that is a free newsletter that we do put out. And again, if you want to find what that number was, go to our website, smartinvesting2000.com. Again, that's smartinvesting2000.com. Right in the middle of the page, you'll see the newsletter. So just click on that. It'll go out to you every Friday at about 5 o'clock. But also, you can see the past issues as well of things we've written about in the past every week. But let's talk about the Visa because with that change, it's a positive. And, you know, it's funny. Over the years, I've seen the government try to come out to change this on credit cards, and they just never seem to be successful. But let's take a look at the numbers on Visa. Their symbol is V as in Visa. They're the credit service industry. Only 2.1% float on the shares. 98% institutional owned. P.E. ratio, well, that's still high, 31.9 versus 24.2 for the industry. Price to sales, 17.2 versus 4.7. Price to book value, 14.1 versus 4.6. And price to cash flow, well, that checks in at 28.4 versus 14. So we do have very high valuations on Visa. Do they justify it? Well, the earnings over the last year up 16%. Not much more than the industry, up 15.6. Earnings over the last 5 years, up 12.4. Industry, about 11.3. Sales for Visa, up 7.6%. Not as good as the industry, up 9.4. 5-year growth rate for Visa, based on the earnings estimate from the analysts, 13.3%, also below the industry at 14.5%. I'm starting to question, like, wow, these valuations may be too high because you're paying high up for some good things, and they're not really showing through here. You only get a 0.8% dividend, and this is very surprising to me. They use 21.5% to pay that measly dividend of 0.8%. We do see on the balance sheet, current ratio 1.5 above the initial 1.3. Debt to equity looks good, 0.5 versus 1.4. Net profit margin, maybe that's why it trades so richly, 53.9% is a net profit margin versus 19.9. That sounds too high. Return on equity is 45.3 versus 47.7. These numbers look kind of strange. I think they probably have a small amount of equity. The net profit margin, it's not filtering through, I don't think, on their growth rates. But Chase, what do you got going forward?
Yeah, well, I know they have very strong margins, which I think is part of the problem on why these lawsuits have come through. And I did actually find it real quick. It was the rates would be lowered to 0.04% for 3 years, and the average rate across the networks would be lowered by 0.07% for 5 years. So, I mean, again, it's a small percentage. But I was kind of surprised people talked about this maybe hitting the credit card issuers more. But I think Visa is the one that makes a lot of the profits on it, and they kind of have a little bit more control over the market. So I think this is going to hurt them in terms of their growth rate. Looking at the numbers here for Visa, though, current price is $277.14, 52-week low, $216.14, and the high, $290.96. Year-to-date, it's up about 6%. But over the last 10 years, it's up 461%. So it's done very well. Give you a target sell price on Visa real quick. Going out to September 2025, the estimated earnings per share, well, that's $11.16. Gives us a target sell price here of $185.26. So well below the current price of $277.14. I'd be a little bit worried with this legislation and kind of the target that Visa and MasterCard have on their backs here in terms of maybe constraining growth, especially trading at these lofty valuations.
And you know, I think that it gets a higher multiple is because right now that revenue, those earnings are pretty consistent because people keep swiping the cards. You don't see anything that's going to stop that because people continue to use their credit cards. Now, one thing that I'm just thinking about is that with Venmo, which is really, I think they have growth, maybe people get tired of paying those fees because now you go to the merchant like, oh, what? I got to pay 3% on top of that because of credit card? Maybe that could change things.
It could change it. And also, too, I mean, it's always tough to invest in an industry that's under attack, essentially. So I'd be careful, especially expensive companies like this.
Exactly. All right, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're talking more on Tesla, Disney, McCormick. So stay with us. You're listening to Smart Investing Show with Brent and Chase.
Back in high school.
Alrighty, welcome back to the second half of the Smart Investing Show. We're currently talking about different equities and investments and so forth. We just finished up on Visa. Let's turn the page over. And
I was just thinking, I gave out the ticker symbol for Visa. It's so easy.
Don't think you did either.
Yeah.
I think because it's so easy, we didn't do it. So make sure people hear it. What's the ticker symbol for Visa?
V. V as in Visa.
V as in Visa. No, I think I gave it out when I talked
Maybe
about
you did. I was just thinking, normally I give it out on the second part. I'm like, yeah. I don't think I did. But anyways, I digress.
We're not very excited about buying it because it just is kind of pricey. But
yeah, forget I told you the ticker symbol.
Yes. Let's move on to Tesla, speaking of pricey. Which is, we've not been a fan of Tesla for many years. And again, great car, great CEO, but just been very pricey. And I think that's kind of catching up with them. We'll talk about Tesla a little bit more, what's going on with them. We do see that they're in the auto manufacturers industry. The short on the float is actually up to 3.5%, which is for them, that's a fairly high amount that is rising. Institutional owned is a 45.8%. PE ratio 38.4. That is above the industry at 22.1. Price to sales 5.9 versus 0.7. Price to book value 8.5 versus 3.8. And price to cash flow is 43.4 versus 8.7. Now, all those are above the industry, and you want those lower than the industry. if you want something on sale. PEG ratio, which tells you what you're paying for the future growth, well, that's 4.2 versus 10.2. That's a positive because the lower number there, the better. Now, earnings over the last year have risen by 26.5% for Tesla. Listen to this, below the industry growth of 44.1%. Talk about the sales. Sales over the last year up 12.5%, also below the industry growth of 17%. This is the first time I've ever seen this happen with these type of numbers to where Tesla's way behind the industry. The five-year growth on earnings growth on Tesla is still 15.3. That's about double the industry at 7.5. I think we will see that come down as time goes on, especially after this last quarter report. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes here. We do see no dividend. They don't pay a dividend. Balance sheet, still pretty good for Tesla. 1.7% current ratio versus 1.6. A lot of liquidity to pay their bills. Debt equity, 0.2 versus 0.7. Not much debt on the balance sheet. Net profit margin, still good for Tesla. It has come down quite a bit, but it's still 15.5. That's more than double the industry at 6.4. Return on equity is 24. Versus 15.5, that's a positive. Chase, what do you got?
Yeah, before I get into the normal numbers, I wanted to talk about those Q1, and it wasn't the Q1 earnings sales, it was the Q1 delivery numbers for Tesla. I was shocked that the stock wasn't down more. I mean, they reported Q1 deliveries of 386,810. That fell well short of a mean from 11 estimates compiled by FactSet of around 457,000. By the way, that 457,000 has been lowered throughout the year as well. So they couldn't even surpass a lowered bar, or they missed that lowered bar by still a large percentage. And also, too, you look at the deliveries, they actually fell 8.5% compared to last year. I mean, that's a problem for a, air quote, high growth company. You should not be seeing, you know, with their Model 3s, Model Ys, those mass-produced cars, essentially, you shouldn't be seeing such a decline in deliveries.
And I did see that Tesla, for the first time ever, it looks like they're considering doing advertising. They've never advertised before. They're considering doing that. Now, what that's going to do, it's going to hurt their profit margins. They may get more sales. Now, I think the biggest factor, as talked earlier in the show, is if we see gas prices go up dramatically, I think you'll see the sales come back. But if gas still hovers around where it is and people buy the hybrids, because Tesla does not have a hybrid, they could be having some more difficulties going forward. We'll see what happens. I think it's really dependent on the price of gas at the pump.
Yeah, I have a couple other thoughts on Tesla here, but let me get into the numbers on the current price for it. The company is $164.90. Year-to-date, the stock's down 33%. The 52-week low, $152.37. The high, $299.29. I believe, actually, they hit like a high of, over 400. Is that right?
I believe so. I was hoping you had that pulled up because I believe it was over 400.
It looks like just on the chart here, it looks like it was like 410, and that's just on the – it might have been a little bit higher than that as well. But, I mean, yeah, it's definitely fallen very, very sharply from those elevated levels back in 2021 is actually when it achieved that high. Going forward, though, for Tesla, I go out to December 2025. I see estimated earnings per share of $4.05. That gives us a target sell price here, and it's almost laughable. It gives us a target sell price of $67.23. And the big thing I point out here is
what was that target sell price?
$67.23.
It's not even 100. Okay.
The forward PE is still 42.2, and this is what I'm talking about. If Tesla cannot return to growth, you can't trade at a forward PE multiple of over 40 times. The concern I have here as well is that forward PE, that's assuming that they are able to get back to growth. That 2025 estimate assumes a 41% growth on earnings, but the scary part is there's 37 analysts following it. The low is $1.90 and the high is $7.67.
Oh, wow.
There's still a lot of people out there that I think are huge Tesla believers, and I got to tell you, I'm worried for Tesla's growth. I don't know where it's going to come from. Years ago, it was supposed to be China and outside the U.S. market because they've already done such a good job here in the U.S., I think, of getting that EV penetration. So it was like, oh, yeah, but they're going to grow across the world. Good luck. BYD, man, they are tough to compete against across the globe. I mean, if they were allowed here in the U.S., I think Tesla would be struggling immensely.
And BYD is the automaker in China that has just really come out with car prices that are really cut tremendously. And what has happened is that growth in China is not there for a Tesla because their cars are still more expensive. And I do believe, we've kind of talked about this before, that we talked about with the phones, with Apple phones. China's kind of saying like, hey, buy our products here. You know, you live in China, buy our products, don't buy U.S. products. I think the same thing's happening. Like, we produced a better car. This BYD is the name of the auto manufacturer. Don't buy Teslas, buy a BYD. And I think most Chinese people do that for two reasons. One, cheaper, and also it's a Chinese product. Like, we feel good here about U.S. products. They feel that way there. And I do want to point out, too, that I did notice that the estimates over the last 90 days are down 26%. So they are falling like a rock.
Falling like a rock. I did see yesterday after hours, though, Tesla did kind of get a little post-market bump. We'll see what happens on Monday. They do plan to unveil the robo-taxi service on August 8th. I'll tell you, I'm not optimistic. Why? They've been talking about that all the way back to 2019. Here we are 5 years later. Is it finally going to happen? I don't know.
What is this robo-taxi service?
It's supposed to be kind of that whole concept of using your Tesla essentially to be an autonomous vehicle, to be a robo-taxi. But my concern is, even if Tesla had the technology for it, you still have to go through the regulators to actually monetize this type of deal. I mean, we saw earlier in the year with Cruise, GM subsidiary, where, you know, they've actually proven that the autonomous vehicle is safer than the human driver because of the incident where, you know, a woman got hit by a Cruise vehicle. By the way, she was hit by a human driver first and then went flying in front of the autonomous vehicle. I think even a human driver would have still had the same situation that Cruise did.
Correct.
They had to shut that down. There's no way that Tesla can monetize this until they can get government approval.
Yeah, I was going to say the government regulators, they're very skittish right now about approving anything. And again, when you look at what actually happened, there was a human could have not done any better, probably worse. And it wasn't like the vehicle ran into the person. The person got hit by another car and it flew in front of the vehicle. So it's just, but for Tesla, sorry, that doesn't matter. The regulators are still like, whoa, whoa. And it's been proven, I think you even pointed this out many times, that a autonomous vehicle is actually a far better driver than a human vehicle.
Yeah, they follow all the rules.
Yeah, yeah. So they follow the rules and they're more alert. They're not on their phone driving. They're not drinking, not putting up makeup on. Yeah. You know, they are really paying attention.
But, so. I mean, my point being here is even if they have some great technology to announce in August, it's still going to be impossible to actually monetize that until you get government approval, which who knows. I think the problem with this robo-taxi idea is it has to be, and Mary Barr from GMS essentially said this, it has to be 100%.
Yeah.
I don't know how you get anything 100%.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that will change over time. But the robo-taxi thing for Tesla, that is, I say, years down the road. And they finally got, and I got to say, I'm sorry, I hate it, that ugly tank-looking truck came out.
Cybertruck.
Cybertruck. How many years did that take to come out? And where's their sports car? I don't think they've come out with a sports car yet. That
I don't know.
Back in 2019.
I mean, I just got to say, I mean, the growth is starting to be a big question mark for Tesla. Even with the major decline in stock price, the valuations are still through the roof.
And I want people to realize we're not beating up on the Tesla cars because I think Tesla cars are good cars.
You just beat up on the Cybertruck, though.
Well, the Cybertruck, because it's ugly. I'm sorry. but what you look at is that as the investment goes, the growth is missing going forward, and therefore why pay high multiples for any company?
Yep.
So, all right. Let's talk about Disney. You want to talk about Disney?
Because yeah,
Disney's
Disney
been the news
quick.
A lot. On that proxy fight that they had. Do I have the right Disney up here? Because I don't show my – it says – now I have Disney.NE. Is that the same Disney?
No, you got the wrong ticker in there.
DIS, right?
Yeah, I don't know why you had
– oh.
You must have clicked the one underneath it.
I guess I wasn't paying attention. Too many things going on. There we go, Disney Entertainment. Now we see the short on the float is 1%. Institutional ownership, 67.5%. And I'm sure if you haven't seen it, I don't know what you're looking at, but there was a proxy fight for Nelson Peltz, who's a corporate raider, trying to take over the board of Disney to try to get them to do things. And what's the name? Eisner?
No. Bob Iger.
Iger. Eisner was the old guy.
Yeah.
Guy previous. But he fought it, and Disney won. So Nelson Peltz, you're not going to be able to run the board. So, but Disney does have to pick up what they're doing. We'll talk more about Disney as we go on here, because investment-wise, you want to see what's worth investing in Disney. Their P.E. ratio right now, 72.7. That's very high, but the industry has nothing there at all. We do see price of sales, 2.4 versus 2.1. Price to book value, 2.2 versus 2.9. Price of cash flow, 16.7 versus 19.3. And PEG ratio, 1.3 versus 2.8. So all this, except for the PEG ratio, tells me not a great valuation at this point in time. Take a look at the earnings. They are down 27.6% over the past year. Industry up 66.6. We do see sales for Disney up 2.2 versus 4 for the industry. Five-year growth rate is 19.1 versus 18.4. Now, keep in mind that Disney does have the resorts and the parks, the theme parks, which I do believe account for a good amount of their revenue. They pay a 0.8% dividend, use 18% of the earnings to pay that out. We do see on the balance sheet, current ratio kind of light, 0.8 versus 1.1, but debt to equity does look good at 0.5 versus 1, and net profit margin 3.4 versus 2.1. Return on equity very poor, 3% versus 7.4. What do you got going forward, Chase?
Yeah, so current price here for Disney is $118.38, 52-week low, $78.73, and the high, $123.74. Year-to-date, stock's done, I'm going to say, very well, up over 31%. Going forward, though, for Disney, we go out to, let's see if they report on a calendar year or fiscal year. They do report on a fiscal year. Going out to September 2025, I see estimated earnings per share of $5.50. Gives it a target sell price, unfortunately, of just $91.30. So pretty substantially below that current price of $118.38.
And Disney, I mean, I want to like it because I think they had a high, I want to say close to 200 a few years ago. And now at these levels, it looks attractive. But the concern they have now is like, okay, well, now you've got the board. What can you do with it? How can you turn things around? The theme parks, yes, they do well, but I just can't get excited about being in Disney, buying it, or holding it.
Yeah, and I would say I will commend, I think, their board move that they had, because the big knock on Disney was the succession plan, because Bob Chapek, I think was his name, the previous successor to Bob Iger, it was a failed succession.
Yes.
I will give him some grace, though, and Bob Iger talked about this yesterday. He was saying, you know, I mean, he took over during probably the hardest time. He took over during COVID, where they shut down theme parks.
Yes.
He shut down movie theaters. I mean, it was, I think he could have had one of the best CEOs coming at that point. It would have been darn near impossible. But what I was coming at, where now the big knock on Disney was the succession plan, I think they added James Gorman, who was the prior CEO from Morgan Stanley, and he just went through what many are applauding as a very successful succession. So I think having him now on the board was a very wise move for Disney.
So we'll kind of watch it and see, but I think now best that stock with next year will probably trade, just tread water. Probably.
Yeah, I think there's just not much value in it, obviously. I mean, how much more is it going to grow from here? I mean, how much more does the theme park business have in it? Because I think that's really what got dinged during COVID. We know that they also have the networks that are actually weighing to the downside because cable TV is not keeping up as much. So what are they going to be able to do going forward to actually grow sales, grow earnings? Because having a 20-plus multiple on earnings, you got to, again, be growing. And where's that going to come from for Disney?
Exactly. All right. Let's talk about real estate. And for that, we turn to our real estate expert, Robert Behick from Countywide Mortgage Lending. Robert, how you doing today?
Good morning. I'm doing great.
Well, good, good. I know today we're talking, and I love stuff like this, four steps before you make an offer on buying a home. This can be very valuable for people. What you got there?
It really is, Brent. For number one, stop using your credit cards. Stop using credit cards. It seems like common sense, but you'd be surprised how many people are still charging and racking up debt when we're trying to pull their credit. Step two, don't move money around. So when you have a down payment or you're going to use your earnest money deposit that you're going to put in, people will start moving money from different accounts. Don't do it. We'd rather see two or three accounts where you have monies in an investment account and a savings account and checking than you moving things around, because we have to track and trace all of it, and it just makes it tougher. Step three, get pre-approved, not pre-qualified. There is a huge difference where the underwriter actually looks at your file and gives us the nod, the green thumb, versus just us running numbers to say, yeah, you should, it should work. And then step four, if you like a house, you need to make your best offer. That is the best advice. I worked an open house last Saturday with an agent. We had 80 families come through. Maybe it was my Cybertruck I had out front.
You don't have a Cybertruck, do you?
No, I don't.
I know you're a car guy. Like, no, come on.
But you do catch somebody's attention when you see those things around town. Anyway.
It may not be the attention you want, but go ahead.
There was six offers. In the family that ended up with it, actually, this was the second home they offered on. But they did all the right things. And so as I tell folks, there's three kinds of people walk through. If they come through and they're just looking how it's decorated, two, they're walking through and they're going, well, maybe this is, maybe it's not. And then there's the third set that walk in the front door and they go, how long's it been on the market? How many offers do you have? And when are they going to be reviewing offers? And once you get to that point, that's the folks that usually I'm talking with, because I have to, what they call cross-qual for all my agents. If you make an offer, we want to look at what your loan officer's offered. So those are the four steps. It's really important. A lot of competition. If you want a house, you need to follow these very specifically.
And I did want to go back to the first one, obviously, stop using credit cards. But I want to be clear, it's not don't use credit cards. Just don't use credit cards while you're doing this process. And then, because we always talk about credit cards can be a great thing with rewards. We'll see how that changes, obviously, with potential changes from Visa and MasterCard. But during this process is when you want to make sure it's clean for the mortgage brokers there.
And you're right, Chase. But here's the thing is that folks will start making big purchases for whatever reason.
Oh, they start buying the furniture and the washer and dryer. Is that what they're doing before they got the house?
And they don't have a house yet. Come on. So during the process, this whole thing can be over within a month. But during that process, I understand there's the Easter sale. There's the President's sale. There's, you know, there's always a sale, 4th of July, whatever. Don't buy until you see the whites of their eyes, till it's closed. Then you can go out and get all the things you need. But wait, please, please, well, please, please.
And also, too, I mean, yeah, you might get some rewards on the cash back, let's say, but it could cost you some interest rate points, essentially, at the end of the day, and cost you way more money than the rewards you get back.
It's so true. And folks just, they don't think about it. It's just not, it's something that they pay it off. I hear this all the time. But that doesn't mean that the cycle on the credit reports picked it up. You could pay your card off every month, but we still see balances because of when we pulled your credit report. Maybe the system hasn't swept yet and picked up that payment being made. So it affects your score.
And Robert, I have to pick on number four because this goes against everything you learn in negotiation. Hold back what you're going to be and so forth. But this is now different because if you have six other offers, 80 people, I think you said, going through that house, to try to negotiate, you're in no position at all to negotiate. You do have to make your best offer. Is that what you're saying?
I am. I really would encourage folks. I get it. I'm right there with you. I buy homes all the time. I have a bunch of kids. They are in and out of real estate doing different transactions. And you want to, everybody wants the best deal, me included. But if you want this specific house, you've got to take it on the chin and make it happen.
Yeah, and then you buy that house because you want to live there. This is the house you want. Don't try to be cheap with it because you'll miss it. Make the best offer you can if you really love that house.
At this point in time, that's how it's working. For sure.
Robert, I want to ask you, too. I mean, you gave us four steps. Is it possible for people to call you and you can send them those four steps so they, because those are very good steps that people need to know, and I think a lot of people don't know those.
They can call. They can email us. We have them written down because we go through them every day, all day long. and we will send them to them for sure.
Great. Well, Robert, thank you very much. We appreciate your time, and you have a great weekend. We'll talk more next week.
Take care, guys.
Okay. Bye-bye. Again, as Robert Behick, he is from Countywide Mortgage Lending. He does have those four steps for you. I highly recommend you get those four steps because they are very strong. And not like 20, it's like four. Give him a call. This is his cell phone number, 760-443-3821. Again, that's 760-443-3821. And you can also reach him at countywidemtg.com. Again, countywidemtg.com.
And just as a reminder here, Countywide Mortgage Lending is a division of Golden Empire Mortgage, Inc., NMLS number 1104585, licensed by the Department of Financial Protection and Innovation under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. Countywide Mortgage Lending is an equal housing lender and proud member of the BBB.
That's some good information on those four steps. And you know, and I don't know if he meant, but I think he said that house was in Escondido, I think he said.
I think that's what he said. Yeah.
Yeah. So, alrighty. Well, let's move on and let's talk about something spicy here.
Yeah, spice things up.
Spice things up and talk about McCormick & Company. You know, I remember this company when I was a kid. They've been around for a long, long time. But let's take a look at if it's time to buy this company or not, because they came out, when was it? I think it was like last week or so. And where is it here? It says that sales rose 3% in the spice merchant's February quarter, delivering 63 cents a share in cash earnings per share and beating the 58 cent estimate. So they've had some good news here. I guess people like spices. You like something they put out. What is it you like?
Oh, I was just looking at what they have, and they have my two favorite sauces.
Two favorite.
They have Frank's Red Hot, which, you know, the saying is you can put that on anything, you know.
It's red hot.
The
I'm
bad
putting
word,
on
yeah.
nothing.
I love Frank's. I mean, I put it on pasta. I put it on chicken. I'll put it on ground beef. I put it on a bunch of stuff.
You have my wife, Christina. She puts hot sauce on everything. It's like, why
it's not just hot sauce. It's Frank's.
Frank's hot sauce. Yeah, yeah. Even better.
Yeah. No, okay. I won't do any hot sauce. I do Frank's hot sauce. The other sauce they have is Cholula, and I love Cholula because Cholula is great on like eggs, breakfast burritos, things like that. So I didn't know they had Cholula. I thought they had Frank's, and I confirmed they do. They also have French's, which I think does like mustard and some other stuff. So yeah, I mean, they got other things outside of just spices.
Yeah, my wife Christina loves that Cholula as well. Cholula?
Cholula.
Cholula. Okay. Well, let's see if it's a not just a good thing to buy spices. And do you have more things on the company to other products besides the two spices you like?
They have other products. I mean, they have a laundry list of them. So, I mean, those are just, I'd say, my favorites.
Okay. Let's talk about to see if this is time to invest in this company. Again, they're in the packaged foods industry. No shortage float, nothing short on the float side. Institutional owned, 88%. We do see a PE ratio, doggone it, 29 versus 21.3, a little bit high. Price of sales, 3.1 versus 1.2. Price to book value, 3.9 versus 2.4. Price to cash flow, 16.1, well above the industry, 11.7. Now, the PEG ratio does look good, though, 3.9 versus 40.9. That's a positive. Their earnings over the last year up 6.1%, not as good as the industry, up 8.4%. Sales rose by 4.8%. Now, the industry was down 8%, so that's a positive there. Five-year growth rate on this spice company, McCormick, is 7.2% above the industry at 6.1%. You get a decent dividend, 2.2%. They use 60% of their earnings to pay that out. We do see on the balance sheet, you got a current ratio of 0.7 versus 1.3. That could be in the danger zone. That's you start to lose your liquidity. That could cause some problems. Debt to equity looks okay, 0.9 versus 1.0. And then that profit margin checks in at 10.6. That's very good because the industry is at 6.1. And return on equity, 13.5. Not as good as the industry at 24. Chase, what do you got?
Yeah, so current price here again for McCormick & Company, their ticker symbol is MKC. It's $75.47. See the 52-week low here? Wow, $59.13. So it did dip down quite a bit. 52-week high, though, $94.39. So almost smack dab in the middle of those two. Year-to-date, I see it is up 10%. Let's go forward, though, and take a look at those forward estimates for McCormick. I go out to November 2025. I see estimated earnings per share of $3.08. Unfortunately, it gives a target sell price of $51.13. So this is a expensive spice company.
And that's where we say buy the Cholula, Did I say it right, Cholula?
Cholula.
Don't buy the stock. And it's such a shame because this is a type of company I like to buy. It's simple. It's easy. AI is not going to change this company. You're not going to, oh my gosh, we're out of business because of AI. People love spices. And I hope you got some other spices you can tell us about that.
I was going to tell you, you know how much I love Frank's? Harrison and I, we used to live together. We used to be roommates, and our now wives came over, and they always make fun of us because you open our refrigerator back when we lived together. We had two things. We had a gallon of Frank's Red Hot Sauce.
A gallon?
A gallon, because we put it on everything. And we had Coors Light, and that was all we had in our fridge.
Well, that's what bachelors do.
So I guess, needless to say, it's probably good that we're married now and our wives don't allow us to live like that.
Yeah. And I know McCormick does make pepper. I'll use a little bit of pepper.
Yeah, salt. I mean, they have your traditional spices that you get at the grocery store.
And I thought they owned, I could be wrong on this, and I forget, I think it was Mrs. Dash or something. I don't know if they, I think there's somebody other, another company.
Could have been Miss, yeah, I didn't see Mrs. Dash in the summer. And I just looked at a quick summary of it, but I mean, they have a lot of different ones.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, there's the closing bell. Thank you for listening to Smart Investing Show. It is for informational purposes only and should not be used as investment advice. If you'd like to discuss in more detail your investment needs, have other investment questions, feel free to call myself Brent Wilsey or Chase Wilsey at 858-224-0004. Again, that's 858-224-0004. Or visit our website, smartinvesting2000.com. That's smartinvesting2000.com. Listen to the podcast there. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week right here on the Smart Investing Show.
So amusing. To think that I did all that, and may I say